Thanks. I'm really grateful to all the organizers, Randy and Kate, for putting this together. It seemed to me to be a great opportunity to try together to try to apply insights from cognitive science with understanding of literature. I've long considered poetry and drama and novels as among the finest human creations, and so the effort to try to get a deeper understanding of why they're so important to people using some of the ideas of cognitive science seems to me both fruitful and very valuable. Let me start by telling you, I guess, one of my favorite media jokes. A man goes into a movie theater and sits down, and he sees a woman come in with a dog. And the dog sits down and beside the woman, and the movie starts, and the dog is actually sitting up straight watching the movie. And at one point the movie's kind of sad and the dog's crying, and then later on there's some jokes and the dog's laughing, and then finally the movie ends quite triumphantly and the dog's jumping up and down. So the man, when this sees this happening, he wonders what's going on, and so when the movie ends, he chases the woman afterwards and said, "Excuse me, I'm amazed your dog actually seemed to be enjoying that movie." And the woman said, "I was surprised too, he hated the book." Okay. Well, I don't think that dogs have big enough brains to enjoy movies or hate books, but people do. And what I'm going to be talking about today is what I think is going on in brains that enables us to do that. Let's get this back. All right, so here's my outline. I was very pleased to find in Microsoft Clipart an extremely powerful model of the human mind. You'll notice that it not only has a blue cognitive wheel, it also has a red emotional wheel. And what makes this model really impressive is that the two wheels interact. And so I'm going to be doing a little bit to flesh out this model today. I'm going to start off by talking fairly generally about comparisons, because I think that all analogies and allegories are comparisons. Then move into analogies, which is something I've done quite a bit of work on from the perspective of cognitive science. Talk about the kinds of constraints that the mind needs in order to do analogies, and then move this into a new territory, at least for me, of how it is that the brain operates with those constraints to make analogy and comparisons and allegory work as well. And then I'll apply it to a couple of 20th century allegories that I think it helps to make sense of why one of these pieces of literature is brilliant and the other I think is a failure. So that will be an attempt to apply these insights to understanding allegory and then wrap it all up. So let me start by giving you some comparisons. These people, it's too bad I don't have Michael Jackson in here today. On the left is Chamillionaire, who's a rapper, and on the right is Weird Al Yankovic. So you'll see in a minute why that's relevant. But let me play you some of these. Whoops. That's not what I wanted to happen. So I need to get some music here. So we'll start with Chamillionaire. Okay, that'll give you an idea of what riding is like. Now let me show you the Weird Al Yankovic. This is more appropriate for the current audience, I think. Yeah. So, 8 o'clock in the morning, I think that, I'm glad everybody woke it up. But it's relevant to what we're talking about today because it's a comparison. It's not an allegory, it's a parody. But you could, I think a lot of the same cognitive processes are involved in both kinds of devices. So, all of these things are comparisons. Parodies, satire, irony, allegory we're talking about today, fables, parables. Metaphors are often like that. So my title, you probably recognize, is from a poem by Emily Dickinson, one of my favorite poets. Another of her favorite poems of mine starts, "Hope is the thing with feathers that perches in the soul." So metaphor can involve implicit comparisons. Analogies, of course. A lot of my favorite jokes, it turns out, are comparisons, are analogical. So I'll give you one example. Some of you are wrapped up in administration. You probably appreciate the saying of Sidney Smith. There was a 19th century cleric who said that changing a university has all the difficulties of moving a cemetery. Another one that I like is that psychologists have stopped using rats in their experiments, and now they use lawyers. And there are three reasons for that. First of all, there are now more lawyers than rats. Secondly, they found that they were getting attached to the rats. And the third reason that psychologists decided to stop using rats in their experiments and use lawyers is that there are some things that rats just won't do. Okay. So again, you've got this sort of systematic comparison. I've got one other academic joke that I'll save for later. The opera one is a remark I recently heard attributed to Mark Twain, who said of an opera that he'd seen that he hadn't heard anything like it since the orphanage burned down. Okay. Now, what's interesting about that one, the opera one, it's also true of the moving the cemetery, but it's also true of the parody that I showed you, the Weird Al Yankovic version of the rap song, is that they're multimodal. As Ray Gibbs talked about yesterday, when we're doing analogies, we're doing allegories, I think, as well, we're not just thinking in terms of the words that are involved. People tend to concentrate that because we see so many things in text and we're talking to each other in words. But they're using lots of different modalities, lots of different kinds of perception. So in the parody that I showed you, the Yankovic, he's using exactly the same rhythms as the rap song. And so he's carrying over the musical structure, even though he's changing the content in quite interesting ways. He's also using various visual images and carrying them over. So you see that there's money changing hands in both of them, one case for drugs and the other case for the Star Trek. In the case of the academic joke about moving the cemetery, I think there's a kind of olfactory characteristic that you can try to figure out how that applies to academia. So in all these cases, we've got comparisons that are involving lots of different kinds of sensory modalities. So the question is, how do we do this? Well, here's where, at least as an initial pass, a theory of analogy that Keith Holyoke and I developed in the 80s and 90s might be useful. We published a book called Mental Leaps, in which we said that when people do analogy, and I think this is going to apply to parody and allegory as well, they're using three main constraints. Everything can be similar to everything else, but in order to use an analogy or an allegory or a parody to make it work, you've got to make the comparison work in a sensible way. And the three constraints that we identified are similarity, structure, and purpose. So the similarity side is looking for things that just map on. And when you're using words, if it's a text, if it's a poem, the most obvious way of doing it is with semantic similarity. That is, the words have similar meanings. But in any of these multimodal analogies, you've got other ways of doing it too. You can see that things are perceptually similar, as you did in the song. The beat is carried over from both of them. But it's not enough to just have similarity. In order for something to be an analogy, it has to have also a fairly rich structure. And the structure involves a couple of things. One, in the absolute level, is a one-to-one mapping. And so you want to have a comparison so you can line the things up so that one thing corresponds to one thing in the other. But you also want to have complex relations that map over so that if something does somebody to something in one part of it, well, that's going to correspond to something doing something to something in the other one, and so you want the relations to carry over in quite a neat way. The third constraint on analogy that Keith and I talked about was purpose. All analogies, we claim, have purposes. They have different purposes. Some are to make you laugh, like my jokes. Some are to, and I guess that's true of the parody as well, some are instructional, the kinds of things that are used in science education. I think that's probably true of the medieval and Renaissance analogies that some of you study. They were intended to be instructional, to give people guides to how conduct should be performed. So you always want to keep in mind with an analogy what the purposes are. With all of these purposes, or all of these constraints get applied to the different stages of analogy. And so drawing on not just our work, but lots of other work done in cognitive science by people like Deirdre Gentner, Keith and I discuss all the different processes, all the different stages that are involved. What psychologists usually talk about most often is retrieval from memory, where you're trying to solve a problem and then you remember something and you pull it out of memory and then you're able to use it analogically to solve a problem for you. But what's interesting about allegory is that I think it's an example of a relatively rare use of analogy where you don't just find something or pull it out of memory. You actually construct it. You have to generate something which then provides the analog that you're going to use. And this has actually been the case in some of the most important uses of analogy in scientific discovery. When Maxwell used an analogy to come up with his equations for electromagnetism, he wasn't able to draw on some phenomenon that was already understood. In fact, he created a mechanical model and then thought about what equations might describe the operations in that mechanical model and used that to come up with a theory of a theory of electromagnetism. The same thing happened with the discovery of the structure of DNA. When Crick and Watson figured out the structure of DNA, they used physical models. They used Tinker Toy models because it's too hard to keep in the mind at once. They're trying to deal with this incredibly complex structure, the twisted DNA, and they did it by building the model and then analogizing from that to what they thought to be the structure of DNA. And I think the same thing goes on in allegory. When a clever author uses an allegory, they're having not to draw on some example that they can just carry over right away. They have to build it. And I think that's an extremely interesting process. Not one that's, in fact, very well understood in cognitive science. What's better understood is ways in which people can map the two analogs together, how you can see the similarities between the Chamillionaire song and the Weird Al Yankovic parody of it, do the correspondences, how you can then transfer things over. This is most often done in problem solving, where you're trying to solve one problem, you come up with an analogical one, and then you transfer over the solution to it. And also, how you can learn from it. Once you've used an analog problem to solve some problem that you've got, you can generalize from that. I'd be curious to hear from you whether anything that goes on in allegory, do people just use allegories as particular examples, or are there cases where people generalize and form a sort of analogical schema that can apply in multiple cases? This is something that happens in analogical problem solving quite a lot, but I don't know whether it happens in the use of analogy. Maybe you can find some examples. Okay, that gives you an account of the sort of state-of-the-art of analogy research as of the mid-90s. But cognitive science has moved on in interesting ways since then. I think there are at least three important developments that I'd point to. One is this kind of thing that Ray Gibbs was talking about yesterday, is a greater emphasis on embodiment and the way in which perceptual processes tied in with our bodily systems are important to cognition. A second that I'm particularly interested in is more emphasis on emotion, and I'll talk about that more. But a third that I think really fits very nicely with the other two is greater emphasis on what the brain does. So what I want to move now is to talk something about how the brain does analogy, because I think there are insights that are gained by moving in that direction. So I took my initial title from this beautiful poem by Emily Dickinson, "The brain is wider than the sky, for put them side by side, the one the other will include with ease and you beside." Now, I don't know what she meant by that, but let me tell you how I interpret it. The way it seems natural for me to interpret it is that what makes the brain wider than the sky, more powerful in some sense, is in fact the brain can represent the sky in a way, but the sky can't represent the brain. That is, you can use the brain not only to describe you can use your brain not only to describe the sky as blue or vast or cloudy, but also to consider the sounds that are involved in it, lightning or thunder and things like that. And you can also represent yourself. And so the way I find it natural to interpret this, so what I'm going to talk about now is how it is that brains do this. How is it that brains are able to represent the sky and cells and everything else? Now we'll move from Emily Dickinson to Stephen Colbert. Because my favorite short description of the way brains work actually occurred on the Stephen Colbert Report. He was interviewing Steven Pinker, who's a famous psychologist, writes about popular books. And Colbert always gets in the face of academics, if you've seen him interviewing. And he says, "Okay, tell me, Professor Pinker, in 5 words or less, how does the brain work?" Now, Pinker's pretty quick on his feet, but he looked a little taken aback. And then he said, "Brain cells fire in patterns." This is actually, I think, quite brilliant. In 5 words, he captured it. Brain cells fire in patterns. So I'm going to give you some idea of how that actually works. That's what brain cells do. You got 100 billion of them, and they're firing in patterns, and that's what enables you to represent the sky and yourself and do poetry and allegory and all these other great things. And you can actually show, with a little bit of back-of-the-envelope calculation, that there are more possible patterns of brain states than there are all possible kinds of things in the universe. Students of poetry may think it's a defamation that I should turn Dickinson's beautiful poem into mathematical truth, but I think it is. But what are these representations? Well, one of the great things, I think, about moving to thinking in terms of the brain and moving away from more verbal representations is you get to pull in all these other kinds of modalities. You get to pull in sound and smells and kinesthetic things and all the other things that I think are part of life, but they're also part of appreciating a lot of really great poems and novels and plays as well. Another thing that you can start to do is to tie in with the overall processing you're considering the fact that all these representations have emotional associations. Cognitive science has been sort of slow to realizing the importance of emotion. And it was sort of an add-on in the last decade or so. The view is that there's this fundamental kind of processing which is language-like, it's cognitive, and there's all this stuff about emotion, but, well, that's sort of on the side. We don't need to worry too much about that. But I think there's loads of evidence, both from seeing how the brain works, but experimental evidence as well as too, that emotion isn't just an add-on. It's part of all cognition. It's tied in right from the beginning. So the brain helps to make it see that, because you can get an understanding of how the emotions are pervading everything we do. But first let me tell you something about how neural representations work. So this is a video that was produced just last week by Terry Stewart, who's a postdoc working with me and Chris Eliasmith. Chris Eliasmith is a colleague of mine in philosophy. He's also the head of the Center for Theoretical Neuroscience here, and has, I think, the best current theory of how neural representation works. And Terry managed to turn this into this really nice visual display. So what I'm going to be showing you here is... let's see, does this work? Yeah, up here, this is the input. This is just a very simple kind of perceptual input. It's a grid 5 by 5, 25 squares. And you can think of that as representing a visual display that somebody is seeing. And down here, we have an array of 2,500 artificial neurons that are running in a computer program. They're all hooked up to each other. This is a 50 by 50 grid, so there's 2,500 of them. And what these neurons are doing is firing in patterns. They're firing in the patterns they do because of the connections they have with each other. Neurons can excite each other or inhibit each other. It's all working enormously in parallel, and that's what they're doing. So let me show you how this works. So Kerry now is running this movie, and so he's clicking up there, and he's putting a pattern there, and you'll see how the neurons at the bottom are starting to fire. The firing of neurons is actually the yellow dots, if you can see them. It starts white, and then as the current builds up in the individual neurons, they go to gray, and then to black, and then when they spike, when they fire, that's what the yellow is. So if you notice on top, he's changing the pattern, and the changing the input pattern, the visual pattern, and down there you can actually see these artificial neurons spiking in different ways. So for each of the inputs, there's a different pattern. So I think this gives a nice illustration of what it is that people now think brains are doing. Now we might ask, why don't you have the neurons firing so that it looks like the input that's coming on top? And the answer is, well, we could do it that way, and there are some sort of parts of the brain that work that way. So there's part of a cat's brain, for example, if you show it a line, there's a line of neurons will fire. But usually it's not like that. Usually the pattern doesn't look, in fact, like what's going on in the world. And that's really important, because the same kinds of neural patterns of firing are being used not just for pictures, but when you're using sounds or smells or all the verbal things that we do. And so it shouldn't look like the other things in the world. So how can we apply this to brains? I mean, you've obviously got a lot of different patterns that can operate in the brains, but how can you translate the constraints that Keith and I identified over to talking about the brains? Well, the similarity one is fairly easy to do, because we know that the brain has areas dedicated to particular kinds of processing. You do visual reasoning coming out of the back of the head occipital lobe, and various kinds of kinesthetic reasoning and motor areas up here, and there's certain areas where you can identify olfactory reasoning going on. And so similarity can just be a matter of similar patterns of activation operating in both cases. What's been much harder to say is how the brain can deal with structures, how neural networks can deal with structures. So take something like Jennifer loves Brad. You might think you could have a Jennifer neuron. There actually is a Jennifer Aniston neuron, at least according to some studies. But a Jennifer Aniston neuron and a Loves neuron and a Brad neuron, and why not just fire all these three neurons together? Well, the problem is that if you just do that, the brain won't know the difference between Jennifer loves Brad and Brad loves Jennifer. And these are relatively important differences. So how does the brain do that? How does it keep track of structure? The dominant view that people have worked with is it's a matter of synchrony. It's a matter of timing. That the brain somehow manages a kind of coordination of different parts of its representation, so they get tied together. So you know that Jennifer is going to be the subject of the action, and Loves is the action, and Brad is the recipient. And so you can use synchrony to bind those things up. There's another way of doing it that Chris Eliasmith has developed called convolution that I'm going to be talking about. I'm only going to give you the metaphorical version. Convolution is an old word. Nowadays we mostly know it because in recent decades it's come to mean excessively complicated. As you say, all ideas are convoluted. But that's not the original meaning. It goes back to the 17th century. Convoluted just means twisted together. I like the metaphor of braided. And so you can think of the ways in which our brain representations get braided together. And I'm going to show you in a minute how that works. The third constraint that Holyoke and I identified was a constraint of purpose. How does the brain mark purposes? Well, that's where I think emotions are really important, because the purpose of what you're doing is something that's encoded emotionally. How does that work? Well, here's a model of how the brain processes emotions that I published last year. I won't go into any of the details of it, but let me give you at least a sort of a metaphorical picture of what's going on here. You all know the metaphor of the stream of consciousness. But that's a good metaphor for consciousness, but it's a really bad metaphor for thinking. There's still a lot of work in cognitive science that tries to make thinking into a kind of serial stream. But what we know about the brain suggests that the brain isn't like a stream at all. It's like an ocean full of currents, many different currents going on simultaneously and mingling in different ways. And this model of emotion is an attempt to say what some of the currents are. Currents that involve both high levels of inference and cognitive appraisal that go on in your prefrontal regions, but also currents that involve visceral responses, physiological things that are going on, the sweaty palms and the beating heartbeat and things like that. And so with this model of emotion, what I try to do is try together these different currents so the brain is processing emotions by being both perceptive of its physiology and doing this high-level kind of cognitive appraisal. So my take now to my update of our 1990s theory of the constraint of purpose is the brain is doing all that by doing these combinations of cognitive appraisals and physiological responses and being able to estimate what matters to the whole system based on this kind of parallel current-like processing. Okay, now we got to get to something, get to allegory. And as a first pass, I'm going to suggest a technique that I recently developed for another purpose. I'm working with a group of people, mostly social scientists, on questions of conflict resolution. And there are a lot of cognitive techniques that have been used for understanding conflict resolution, the sort of things that can go on in understanding, say, Middle East conflicts, international conflicts, or even interpersonal conflicts. But cognitive mapping has been a useful tool for that, but I think it's neglecting the emotional side. And so I've been trying to develop a technique I call cognitive affective mapping to get the emotions in as well. So what you want to be able to do in understanding conflict is to see not just what the elements are, not just what the concepts are and the beliefs are, but understand the emotional significance of them. And I think that approach is also very helpful for doing allegory. Because I don't know about the medieval Renaissance cases you study, but the ones I've looked at, the 20th century ones, the purpose is really important. They have a political purpose often, or they could have a didactic purpose, but in all cases there's something emotional that needs to be carried across. And what I'm going to try to do now is give you an illustration how you can use cognitive affective mapping to bring out the emotional structure and therefore the purpose of what's going on in the allegory. Well, things like Pilgrim's Progress and Piers Plowman are way beyond my realm of competence, so let me try something a lot simpler. I reread Animal Farm. I guess the last time I read it was probably when I was a teenager, and I liked it then, but I enjoyed it even more now, because since then I've read quite a bit about the Russian Revolution, and it was all the easier to make the correspondences. So you can think of this just in cognitive terms as an example of an analogical mapping. So what Orwell does in his fable is to map the pigs onto the communists, the humans are the aristocracy, dogs are the secret police, Napoleon is the is Stalin, the chief pig, Snowball is the pig who loses out, so it looks like Trotsky, Frederick the human is Hitler, Boxer is the horse who's kind of victimized and it corresponds to the proletariat. So I think this is a nice example of analogical mapping. It's the sort of thing that the kinds of programs that Keith and I developed, computer programs that Keith and I developed back in the 80s could easily do. We could make these correspondences in our computer model quite well. But I think if we'd done that, we would have been missing something important. We would have been missing the emotional structure of it, things that we weren't thinking about much back in the 80s and 90s. So here's my attempt to give a cognitive affective map that indicates what I think is getting better at the structure of what the purpose of what Orwell was trying to do with his allegory. So it looks like a cognitive map in that I've got some key concepts and propositions. But the main addition that I've used here is that in order to convey the emotional part of it, the affective part, I've adopted the convention that anything involving a positive emotion, something you approve of, something that makes you feel good, is represented by a red oval. And anything that you find painful or emotionally negative, I've represented by a blue hexagon. And so let's see how the structure corresponds. So looking just on the left part there, you've got the revolution stage. And on the top, you've got what happens in Orwell's Animal Farm, the pigs overthrow the humans. And this corresponds to the Russian Revolution, the bottom part, where the communists overthrow the monarchy. But what the correspondence here is not just one that involves the overall structure, it's also one that involves the mapping. I think Animal Farm was extremely popular in the United States because people read it as a anti-communist diatribe, but of course that's not how Orwell meant it at all. He was a socialist. He was trying to show something about what went wrong with the Russian Revolution. So for him, I think the notion of overthrowing the pigs by the humans who were oppressive, or the communists overthrowing the feudal system in Russia, was actually a positive development. So that's why I've marked them with red ovals. The result, however, was from Orwell's perspective, and mine as well, was rather sad, because the pigs betrayed the animals. So the pigs started off as good guys, but they end up as bad guys. And so that's why I've shifted them from being red ovals to blue hexagons. And betrayal, of course, is negative, and you've got the emotions lining up as well. So the communists betray the workers, like poor Boxer, the proletarian. So the purpose here of the introducing emotion into it, my red circles and the blue hexagons, is to try to show that the analogical structure is not just a matter of the concepts and the relations, but it's actually lining up the emotions as well. I'd be very curious to hear whether some of the earlier examples of allegory that some of you have studied have that same property. So I think what one of the things this enables us to see is why Animal Farm succeeds brilliantly. I thought it was wonderful reading it again after many decades. And the reason is, first of all, that the structure is sufficient to carry the meaning. Notice, though, it actually violates some of the constraints that are part of the theories of analogy that Keith and I and people like Didner Gentner have adopted. One thing is that there are mismatches. It violates, in fact, principles of one-to-one mapping. As far as I can tell, Napoleon the pig in Animal Farm maps onto both Lenin and Stalin. There are some models of analogy like Gentner's that couldn't even do this as part of their program. Their program would choke and die. Our models are a little more flexible than that, and we could actually do this kind of one-to-two mapping. But you can loosen up the constraints, and it doesn't matter because the purpose still carries over. Trotsky, Snowball seems to be Trotsky, but it could be many other dissidents who got suppressed by Stalin. And Boxer, of course, isn't just one worker. Boxer's standing for many workers. It doesn't matter, though, that there's a mismatch here, that it doesn't do a perfect job of carrying over the structure, because the purpose carries over. You've got Orwell's approval of the overthrow of the feudal system in Russia, disappointment at the betrayal. One thing I didn't mention that comes through a lot is his outrage at the distortions of history that came about when Stalin rewrote the history of the Russian Revolution. And of course, sympathy for the workers, which was a big part of Orwell's political perspective through the whole thing. So I think this gives you the cognitive affective mapping gives you a way of seeing why the allegory works as well as it does. Despite the fact that it violates some of the constraints on analogical mapping. I think the way of thinking of allegory as a purpose-driven emotional analogy also gives you an idea of seeing why sometimes allegories fail. This is a horrible book. Jose Saramago won the Nobel Prize in Literature. I don't know why. This book, Blindness, was made into a movie, and I've been told that the movie is even worse than the book. The book I just hated. The only reason I finished it was as part of my book club. And so I had to at least have finished it so that I could complain about it. And why does it fail? It fails for all the reasons that I think can be understood in terms of the kinds of constraints I talked about. What's my justification for calling it for an allegory? Well, the back of the book says it's an allegory for all the woes of the 20th century. And you can sort of see, I mean, there's horrible things. There's things like ethnic cleansing, Holocaust, maybe lots of sexual violence. The book ends with a sort of miraculous, well, I shouldn't tell you the ending. Yes, I should. That way it'll discourage you from reading it even more. But none of the mappings are clear at all. I mean, the book is horribly written. It's run on sentences and run off paragraphs and running ideas. And it doesn't make any kinds of neat analogical comparisons at all. So what's the purpose? Are you supposed to transfer outrage, but to what? Despair, but to what? I mean, I think none of the emotional purposes that an allegory might have are accomplished by this book. So one of the things I hope that a theory of analogy that takes into account purposes will be able to do is to, and emotions, to indicate why some books are really good and others aren't. It raises a much more general question of why read fiction at all? And I'm absolutely delighted that literary theorists are starting to answer this question. I think it's a fascinating question. Now, Lisa Sunshine is a literary theorist who's written a book with the title Why I Read Fiction, and she gives an answer that I think is at best only partial. She says we read fiction to use the theory of mind, which is an idea that a lot of people in cognitive psychology have talked about, to attribute states to fictional characters. And that's certainly something that goes on. I mean, she actually says, well, I like to be able to think of what's going on inside the minds of the characters that I'm reading about in novels. But I think for a lot of the appreciation of literature, at least by ordinary people, ordinary readers like me, is a better account comes from a different view. That, in fact, what happens when you read fiction is a matter of simulation. You're living some of what they're doing. So Ray Gibbs yesterday talked about simulation as part of what goes on in understanding the world. There are a couple of Toronto psychologists, Martin Oatley, have a recent paper where they talk about ways in which when people are reading fiction, they're simulating the world. They're abstracting, but seeing analogies between what's going on in the fictional worlds that are being described and their own lives. And I think this is true of at least some of my favorite characters in literature. There's a kind of empathic identification that could go on. Things like characters like Irina in Chekhov's Three Sisters. I just saw a wonderful performance of it in Stratford. Or Hamlet with the kinds of doubts and difficulties he deals with, or Larry in Carol Shields' novels, Larry Party. I mean, there's ways in which you can get identifications. It doesn't have to be identical. You don't have to be able to have some sort of identical. The point of analogy isn't to have things identical, but at least to see some interesting correspondences so you can do some comparisons that are revealing to you. Well, one thing that can happen from this in the really great cases is you get something very much like the aha experience, which I think occurs in science. I've been working on a paper on creativity now, which is intended to be a neural model of creativity, of what goes on when people put together ideas that hadn't previously been connected, and they come up with something genuinely new. An example would be something like Darwin's idea of natural selection. People knew about evolution, people knew about selection, but he put together the idea of evolution with the idea of survival of the fittest and came up with a really powerful new idea. So this is a new neural model that we're trying to build and that has roughly this structure. It's actually a structure that applies to lots of other things as well. It applies to jokes. So let me tell you my remaining academic joke. This one comes from Daniel Dennett. It's in his book Consciousness Explains, where he tells the story of an animal called the sea squirt that just sort of floats around until it finds a good rock. And then it settles down on that rock, and it no longer needs its brain, so it eats it. It's a lot like getting tenure. Okay, so here he's got this mapping between the sea squirt eats. All right, so you get the idea. So what's happened there is, in fact, an association of ideas that you probably not put together before, sea squirts and tenure, and it's surprising. The idea that there's a correspondence between jokes and discovery is actually a very old one. Arthur Koestler writes about it in his 1962 book, The Act of Creation. And so you could see this as a model not only of scientific discovery, but as a model of jokes as well. So you've got a couple of representations that get combined into a new combination, but what's going on simultaneously, what makes this the aha experience, is it's being tied in with the emotions. So in the model of emotions I described, it's not just a matter of cognitive appraisal, thinking about the extent to which something accomplishes your goals, but also your physiological changes, your what's happening to your heartbeat and other kinds of hormones that are circulating in your body. And then you need to put this all together, and I think it's when you put together that combination of new ideas and the combination of the cognitive appraisal and the physiology, and it all comes together. How can it come together? Well, if you tried to think of this as a step-by-step serial process, if you tried to understand it as a stream, I think it wouldn't make much sense. But if you use the kind of parallel current metaphor that I use for describing how the brain works, it can all happen all at once. All these currents come together in ways that can be spelled out in quite a lot of detail. Let me give you an idea to how that might work. This is my all-time favorite PowerPoint slide. I've given hundreds of PowerPoint presentations, and this is the best slide I've ever had, and this is the first time I've ever shown it. It's, I guess you'd call it an example of visual rhetoric. Not rhetoric in the common sense of a cheap trick, because it's not a trick and it wasn't cheap, but rhetoric in the sense of being part of argumentative strategy. And I think what this can enable you to see is how the kinds of combination that Kessler described as going on in both jokes and scientific discovery can actually occur. So what I'm going to show you here is an extension of that first model of brain representation. So what's going to happen in this little movie is there's going to be one visual pattern represented here and another visual pattern represented here. And that's going to be the same sort of simple kind of 5x5 grid. So it's going to be really quite simple. But it didn't need to be a picture. We can do exactly the same thing with sounds. We can do it with words because we can translate them into neurons as well. And so here's a smaller neural network. It's just 1,600, 40x40. And here's another 1,600 neurons. And this neural network is going to represent this pattern, just as this one does. That's very similar to what you saw before. But then something really cool is going to happen. We've got another neural pattern here consisting of another 1,600 neurons. And actually in the model that Terry has running, this is also done by Terry Stewart, there's a bunch of neurons connecting this to this. We won't show them. What we're going to show is the result of what happens when you combine these neural patterns. It's the same thing that's going on, I think, when Darwin put together natural selection. It's the same thing that's going on in my joke when I put together tenure and sea squirts eating their brain. So let's show you how that's working. So I'll give you a kind of narration of what's happening. Okay, so it starts off, you're going to see a pattern in the two things on the left. So you've got a cross and a diamond. And then you can see the neurons are starting to fire representing that. But what's happening in the right-hand part is the convolution, the braiding together. This is now a new neural population that's actually combining the previous representations. And it doesn't look like anything obvious, but you can see on the thing that's on the very right is in fact the pattern that's being represented. That doesn't look like anything, because it shouldn't, because it doesn't have any direct reference to things in the world. But this is how it is that what's going on in these two patterns of neural two neural patterns have been combined into a new neural pattern. So you can see the yellow lights blinking. And what's going to happen in just a minute is Terry's going to start to modify the patterns. So what's happened now, you can see on the top, you've got a stable pattern, the bottom a stable pattern, and a stable pattern emerged as a result. Now he's changed the pattern at the top, so it's now sort of face-like, and you'll see that the bottom pattern is still the same, but the top pattern has started to change because you have different neurons firing in order to represent it. And then on the right, you've got, in fact, the new convolution of it, the new way in which the patterns are braided together and are representing something new. So what he's going to do after another few minutes, another few seconds, is to change the bottom pattern. And when he does that, you'll get a new stable pattern at the bottom and a new convolution. You'll get a new kind of braiding together. Now, I imagine, I know some of you are talking later about conceptual blending theory of Fauconnier and Turner, and this may remind you of it. And in fact, it's very similar, because they got their ideas also from Kessler. Kessler called it bisociation, Fauconnier and Turner kind of blending. The difference is, here, is that we're not just mushing things together, we're actually maintaining a lot of the structure and showing some underlying neural mechanism of how that kind of blending or integration or bisociation or can take place. So now he's got, at the bottom, he's got a different pattern, and so you can see the neural pattern there is changed, and the resulting neural pattern where you've taken these different ideas, put them together in something new, has also changed. You've produced a new braiding. So I'm running short of time. I want to close though by saying something about beauty. I mentioned the performance I saw recently of Chekhov's Three Sisters. I've been very fortunate in the last month to have three peak aesthetic experiences. If you get one of these a year, you're usually doing pretty well. So the Three Sisters was one of them. Another was seeing a great performance of Beethoven's Ninth that was done at the center in the square here, not with the KW Symphony Orchestra and its energetic young director, but also four fine soloists and a mass choir of 200 people doing the last movement. And so it was really quite amazing, but it came together in the same way. The third one I was going to mention is a meal I had at what was billed as Toronto's best Thai restaurant a couple of weeks ago. And they got a young chef named Sasi who has been written up in Toronto Life and Maclean, so I needed to check it out. And it was actually really quite amazing. It had the same characteristics, I think, of the performance of Three Sisters, of the Beethoven Ninth, the last movement. And it was a case where there were very interesting ingredients, but what made it beautiful, what made all three of these beautiful, is I think that it all came together. You had this kind of what Collingwood called unity and diversity. I think that we're starting to get an understanding of what's going on in the brain that enables people to have these kinds of appreciations of what the unity and diversity amounts to. It's not just a cognitive matter of realizing that there's uniformity amidst variety. It's rather that the brain, when it puts all these different kinds of currents together, the different sorts of perceptual things, the different kinds of, including visual and auditory, as well as our verbal representations, it's putting it together in a way that's highly coherent, not just in a purely cognitive sense, but really an emotional sense. It's all coming together in a way that can be very powerful when you get these kinds of extraordinary performances. So I think that there's a possibility here of using ideas from cognitive science, ideas about the brain works, to get a deeper understanding of some of the things that are involved in the appreciation of beauty, which I think is important for lots of kinds of art and literature. So let me wrap it all up. What are my conclusions here? The first one is that allegories are analogies. I think this probably shouldn't be too controversial. Much more controversial, you can hope I've tried to give you some understanding of it. I've got a little more detail now in my clip art model of the brain. Those gears are turning rather slowly, but I provide a little bit of the mechanisms that are involved and maybe a little bit idea of the kinds of inspiration that can be involved. We're starting to get an understanding, I think, of how brains compute analogies, including the ones used on allegories, using the kinds of constraints that Keith and I talked about a fairly long time ago, but updated to understand how different modalities are being involved with this, and some of the most important modalities they're involved in with are ones that tie the brain activity tightly with emotions, and so the emotional interpretation of the allegory or the analogy or any kind of aesthetic experience is very much tied in with the way our cognitive and physiological processes are involved in emotion. So to sum it all up, I guess I hope I can say that I hope I've done something to convince you that Emily Dickinson was right, that it really is true that the brain is wider than the sky. Thank you.